we welcome to the program our friend, writer Colin Fleming. You can order his newest book. It's part of the 33 and a Third series, Sam Cooke, live at the Harlem Square Club, 1963. Good afternoon, Mr. Fleming.
Kimball, I have to preempt our topics with an accounting of my day, which will blow your mind.
Lay it on me, brother.
So, in the past 7 days, I've written 7 op-eds, as you know, for absolutely no money. And one editor today told me that I was annoying and to stop sending along so much. And then I got into my dealings with the Wall Street Journal, which are going to transition into my recent dealings today with the IRS.
Oh, dear. Fun,
right? So I have this piece coming out in the Wall Street Journal on Sam Cooke, been pushed back a bunch of times. And it was an 800-word piece for $1,000. I'm desperate for the money. I could barely afford the dentist recently. And the guy got the piece from me, and he reads the piece. And he responds to me, say, oh, great job, Colin. And then it just kept getting rescheduled. So today he says to me, you know what? On second thought, it's like, you can't assign something, read it, say it's good, and then rescind. He's like, it's really just kind of a mess. The writing's bad. You should do it all over. We'll put in this other column. And now I'm thinking I'm going to be losing a lot of money here. And then this other guy at the Wall Street Journal, an op-ed editor, he gives me a 3-point blow-by-blow accounting of how much I suck in all various kinds of ways. He says to me, I don't see the point, really, of anything you write. I read it, and I don't see what it's trying to say to me. So I'm going through all of this. I say, you know what? Screw it. I'm just going to open the mail, which I've been avoiding. And the first thing I see is a letter from the IRS. Pop this baby open. It says, by tomorrow, Mr. Fleming, you owe us $90,000. You liking this, Kimball? This
wow.
is good. Yeah, I also wrote a great short story today, finished another one, wrote a different op-ed. So then I'm trying to deal with the IRS because I am so poor, $90,000. I mean, come on. So I finally found out who made the error with the IRS. It was the Dow Jones Company. The Wall Street Journal, who put 2 zeros into my income from 2019. So this place really cost me, in some form, stress or financially, something like $91,500 today. I just wrote the guy about it. And I almost gave into the bottle before you called. But here I am. I just popped some melatonin.
That's a better choice, clearly. And you talk about all the pieces you've written. One of them that also you didn't get published was a piece on Cam Newton, which turned out to be quite prescient.
Yes, and this gets worse, too. I don't think you know this yet. I don't think I emailed you about this. I wrote a second version of this piece, which was from yesterday. And the piece that's up in the blog from yesterday was questioning, one, Newton's professionalism, and two, the comments made by Scott Zolak that Newton perhaps should have the rap music turned down and not be dancing between throws at practice. And I'm someone who, like I said in the piece, it could be the Elgar Enigma variations or John Coltrane's Giant Steps. The fact that it was rap freights it with a kind of racist angle for everyone who's going to hop aboard that particular train. But the quarterback is the field general. It's the closest player to management. And I think you should put forth a kind of professional attitude, bearing all of that. You should be focused on your next throw. And I'd offer that to USA Today. They ignored it. New York Daily News is the guy who kind of like, he's a good guy, but he was annoyed with me. And I could tell he didn't look at it. And then he essentially told me that. But then today, when Newton was released, I did a second version of it. Then I did a third version. And the third version was kind of about like how is not getting the vaccine perhaps costing this guy his career. And I've written about quarterbacks, New England quarterbacks for USA Today a number of times. And I offered him the second one. I offered him the third one. And of course, because this is my life, didn't even respond. And I think you know, and Bruce knows, that some guy reached out to me on my website a few months ago, said, I would like to be a writer and write some pieces. But when I write people, I don't hear back. And I think I'm pretty good with the words. And so what do I do? Is there like, how do I go about this? And Bruce said, this poor bastard has no idea what he doesn't know. And it's like, you've seen it. You didn't. You're a smart man of the world, Kimball. And until you saw this with me, you had no idea that this netherworld existed. Yeah. And it's like this every single day. And it doesn't matter what you do or how awesome it is or if it's the best thing ever written, you're dependent on people who are often envious of you. And just as importantly, are usually incompetent, completely incompetent.
And I think that's the larger factor based on, everything all of us deal with along the way. You can write off much more of the failings of our world, I think, to incompetence and laziness than any kind of a plan. Because my observation is in virtually every area that I walk in, ain't nobody got a plan.
Sure, I think that's true, but it's not true in my world. I mean, the amount of envy and bigotry that I deal with does outmountain the incompetence. But it's like, for instance, I do things, even now, like if you're just listening in, you're probably thinking like, oh, this poor guy. This poor guy has been in every single magazine that's ever existed. He's the best writer in every kind of writing there is. He dominates, better on radio than people, fiction harpers, all these things. That's why I'm paying this price. Because if you're somebody else and you do one of these things, you're going to get the MacArthur Genius Grant. You're going to get the Guggenheim. You're going to get the six-figure book deal. And for me, the more I achieve, and I am kicking the ass of these people every week, even with an industry against me, the harder it gets. As soon as they see the name Colin Fleming at the top of the masterpiece, I'm done. Because a lot of these people, these editors or publishers, they're also writers. So in theory, they're competition. And that's their power. They're not going to let the mega genius, hashtag Genius Lives Matter, get forward into some place that is another place they won't have. But even if you wipe out the bigotry, you're still dealing with the moron. You could play for the moron, a driver's ed film or Citizen Kane. These people don't know, man. They have no idea. They have to be told. And then they, of course, like the culture, they pile on. But they take comfort in other people to put people forward just like them. Because there's no threat. I'm a threat.
Colin Fleming with us here on Downtown. Let's get to some of the items on our agenda for this week. And well, speaking of films, let's start with one from 1956. Moby Dick, such an interesting film. John Huston directed. I like the film in some ways. And one of the reasons I like it is because I think the choice of Gregory Peck as Ahab was not a very good one. And yet it makes me like it even more.
That's interesting because usually I feel like I'm the one with the greater reservations about the films we talk about. But I feel like I'm more enthusiastic, maybe, than you are about this one. I think this film has unfairly been maligned over the years because it doesn't have the philosophical weight of a book like a Ulysses and Moby Dick that doesn't seem like it would translate well to the screen. But Melville started out as this yarn teller of like the Pacific Ocean and Isles and Taipei and all of these travelogue sorts of novels. They were like sort of not really novels, but he called them novels, even though they were based upon his own experiences. So he was just like this rip-snorting kind of teller of tropical tales. And so Moby Dick was a big departure for him, where you're getting into the cetology and all of these other things, which I personally think add a lot to the plot and the characterization. But fundamentally, he was also a plotter. He made plots. He made narratives. So what Huston did was he stripped away a lot of the philosophy, and he gave you the old New England yarn of the whale, which is based upon a true account by Seaman Owen Chase, that took out a ship and a crew, largely. So I think it really works. I like how it looks like an engraving brought to life. And you mentioned Gregory Peck. I find him, I don't know, I find him okay in the role. He really doesn't get in the way of my understanding of the characterization in the narrative as an action yarn of Ahab.
One thing I didn't know, and somehow I missed somewhere along the way until I was doing a little bit of research for our conversation today, is that Ray Bradbury was the screenwriter along with Huston.
Yeah, that is kind of like one of those nuggets that you wouldn't necessarily expect because he was Mr. Sci-Fi. And certainly the 1950s were the decade of sci-fi, not just for movies, but it was also a kind of golden age, or one of them, of the pulps, of the sci-fi pulps. So Bradbury, stepped into the breach with this particular film. And I really like the relationship between the friendship between Ishmael and Queequeg. I find that quite believable in the part with the coffin being made. And Houston was good. Orson Welles was good at this too, of interweaving bits of text, leaving out like chunks of text, finding choice bits and not sort of marooning them. Like Welles would do this with Shakespeare. And if you know the Shakespeare plays, Welles will have like, this is from page 19. And then he'll like join it up with something from page 38. Kind of like the way he shot his films where they're like in this country for this one. And then they're in like Africa for this other one. And he sort of matches them by shooting people from behind. And that's kind of the way that Houston works, I feel like, with the text in this film. There's not, to me, a lot to quibble about with it. But it's really a rousing adventure, too. It's believable. It's sort of a pre-Jaws, certainly. And I don't know. I think it's a pretty good film.
I know. I agree with you on that. I'm not sold on Peck, but I like him so much it doesn't matter. He could do anything, and I would watch. We're talking with Colin Fleming.
You know what it might be is that I'm not really into Peck ever.
Really?
You know, I always find him kind of wooden. They're just certain actors that I don't think like much of. Like who's the guy there in the swimmer?
Burt Lancaster.
I don't think much of him. I don't think much of like Paul Newman. I find them pretty unmalleable, and I feel like Gregory Peck is pretty unmalleable. And in my view, as a person from New Bedford, I feel like a sea captain, a whaling captain in that period, would be pretty unmalleable and unemotive himself. I feel like he'd be pretty stiff. So I think Gregory Peck's deficiencies in some ways work for him. Save maybe when he's like making fiery speeches, but I don't know. I feel like he's pretty consistent with how that obsessive whaling captain would have been.
I had an absolute blast watching the 1965 NME New Musical Express poll winners concert. Man, it was an unbelievable collection. Everybody on the British rock scene, and then a few obscure acts, but my word, early Moody Blues, which was phenomenal. Freddie and the Dreamers, who were just weird. The Seekers, our friend Peter Noon and Herman's Hermits. Beatles, some great Stones. Weird old crazy anti-vaxxer Van Morrison. But the one that blew me away, I thought the best part of the whole thing, Eric Burdon and the Animals, just unbelievable.
Well, you are sort of predisposed to go in that direction. I've seen your little quote on Facebook about don't let me be misunderstood. And yes, Nina Simone, but I thought, oh, Kimball, he's channeling his Eric Burdon. And I thought, correctly, if I'd bet with myself, I'd make a tidy profit, that you would make a Van Morrison vaxxing reference. So I got that. It's actually Van Morrison with them.
Yes.
So it's not like him up there doing like Brown Eyed Girls. So he was, I think people don't know this. A lot of people don't. He was in this smoke and R&B combo called Them, which really, aside from Astral Weeks, might have been the best thing that Van Morrison ever did.
Oh, here comes the Night is just a fantastic song.
Well, they don't have a huge catalog, but they don't really have any duff numbers. And so the Yardbirds aren't there. They'll be there at the 1966 one. The thing about a gig like this is that nobody's going to be terrible. Because you might have been terrible on other nights in random towns or with screening genie boppers, but you're not going to be terrible in front of your peers. So the Beatles are going to step it up, and the Stones are going to step it up, and everybody's going to play well. And a guy like you with your live concert ADD, I figured this would be good, because you're not like, he's noodling. I don't want it more than 3 minutes long. I'm Kimball. Get him off the stage. Where's the hook? So I figured you'd like this, because most groups are up there for 3, 4, 5 numbers. They're punchy. They're 2, 3 minutes, and they get the next act up there. But like, as an all-timer of a bill, I mean, you see some of these ones where it's like Little Willie John, Sam Cooke, and like Little Richard. They're all like on the same bill. So I feel like in England, though, it would have been very difficult to beat this night out.
And also a heap and helping of introductions by noted pedophile Jimmy Savile.
The MCs at these things were always, well, I don't know, they were pretty cartoonish. I put up on Twitter recently the guy who absolutely loses his bleep in Texas in August when the Beatles were on tour in 1965.
Which is great.
He was this DJ. Like, yeah, he flips out at the, like, he really flips out at the concert. And that was the first bootleg I ever owned. Got it at some head shop in Connecticut called Trash American Style. Went back to my buddy's house and we tried to, like, denoise it. And the first thing we heard was this crazy DJ. And I thought, are all these bootlegs, like, was a madman like this screaming at the audience? And it's true. At these bills in the 1960s, you do get a lot of, like, the MC is almost a performer / irritant.
Mm.
And so they're necessary to shepherd you through everything, I suppose, when you have, like, 15 artists on the bill like this. But it can get a bit much, but it's authentic. So it's not like you want it excised.
I enjoyed it. I enjoyed the whole thing quite a bit. While we're talking music and Beatles, let's shift to one of the more interesting songs in the Beatles catalog. What are your thoughts on I Am the Walrus?
I think it's had a critical slamming over the last 20 years. And part of that is because of a book called Revolution in the Head, which I really like. I think it's probably the best Beatles book to date, or one of them. And will be a contender for that title until my Beatles book comes out. But there it is for now. And it takes a critical view of some songs. And I enjoy that type of thing where someone who honestly believes something and can make a case takes something down. And it doesn't threaten my appreciation of it. It doesn't necessarily make me think that that person is right. But he sort of pays I Am the Walrus because it's so many non sequiturs. And what I hear the song is now is a lot differently than the way I heard it for a lot of my life. I've been listening to the Beatles now for 30 years. And so what I hear now is a psychedelic rhythm and blues mashup via radio, Shakespeare, and sound collage with a driving Lennon vocal. And I know it's heavily processed and it's automatically double-tracked, and he wanted to sound like a monk with a bunch of monks chanting around him, but it's a forceful, driving vocal, and it does sort of pull on that rhythm and blues propulsive element that the Beatles were all about in 1963, but you'd never think of it as rhythm and blues because it's Crab a Locker, Fishwife, Pornographic Priestess, and oh, untimely death piped in from the BBC doing Shakespeare. But really, it's underpinned by rhythm and blues. I think that's fascinating. And it's not a point anyone has made about the song, but listen to how driving it is, how rhythmic it is.
I like the song a lot, and I like the fact, and maybe it's because of the video as well, but they just seem to be having a whole lot of fun on that record.
They did. I think that's an offshoot of how Lennon would cut loose. Someone really early to me in my writing career said, never think that you're going too far. If it's working, don't think that. Don't think because other people don't do it. They said, you have a gift, and go as far as the gift can go in everything you create. And I've never, like, looked back. I never thought, oh, you can't do this because everyone else does this. Even though, like, for the time being, I'm paying a price. But this is the rock and roll version of that, where Lennon was doing things that nobody was doing with this particular cut. It's not just the vocal. It's not just the lyric. It's the entire compositions, the way everything comes together, the sound effects from the radio. And so, like, the music video, which wasn't technically a music video, it's a bit from the film, is an extension of that. It's a visual extension of that cutting loose. But it's cutting loose with the control, because think of how he says words, lines that are seemingly nonsensical. He sings them with utter conviction. And so a kind of meaning comes over in the performance that you don't get straight away or at all from the lyrics on the page, where it can be like gobbledygook.
Colin Fleming with us here on Downtown. From there, we move to baseball and the curious case of Max Bishop, who has some of the more interesting stats in the history of the game.
I am such a lonely loser that what I do, Kimball, is I just stare at Baseball Reference. I look at comparables. I mean, when I'm not doing all the other things that I do, but when I have that time come to an end, I'm just staring at Baseball Reference in my lonely, lonely life. So I see numbers that are just, well, they're crazy. And I've tried to see if anyone has numbers like Max Bishop, the second baseman who he played a couple of years with the Red Sox at the end of his career in the mid-1930s, but he was mostly known as a member of the Philadelphia athletics. And yes, I know this sounds ancient to everybody, but you can make a really great case that Max Bishop played on the best baseball team of all time, mm-hmm. because that dynastic A's team, circa like 1930, is pretty close. Jimmy Fox, a bunch of other guys, Mickey Cochran, players like that. But I've never seen anything like his 1930. And I don't have the numbers exactly in front of me, but I know this. He had over 100 runs scored. He had over 100 bases on balls, and he had less hits than he had of either of those two other things.
Yeah,
I don't think that's ever been done before.
It's incredible. And they used to call the Red Sox, I think it was the third base coach for him, Eddie Yost. They used to call the walking man. Eddie Yost had nothing on Max Bishop, who year in and year out, and this is in a 154-game schedule, would always walk at least 100 times.
He would, but it's the sort of like the topography of the numbers. You can have more runs scored than hit. It's mind-boggling.
Yeah.
But there he is. But then he has more bases on balls than hits, too. And so I'm looking at his comparables on Baseball Reference, and I'm going through some guys. And, like, the way you have to do this, like Ferris Fane, kind of similar, but he won a couple batting titles. The way you have to do this is suck at hitting. Like, you have to be like, no power, no pop, nothing like that. You hit, like, 237, but you have a great eye. So it's like God is handing out the offensive tools, right, up in heaven. And he goes, you shall have the eye, but not the stick. And it's, like, really strange, right? Because normally they go hand in hand. They're related. Like a guy who sees the ball really well, which you have to do to walk this much, like a Barry Bonds, who also, like, gets his pitch, hits it, like, on the sweet spot of the bat, but not Max Bishop. When he made contact, he was kind of like dribbling to the second baseman on the other team.
Yeah. I don't know if there's ever been a guy that could do this. It would hit, as you said, 230, 240, but have a 400-plus on-base percentage.
No, and it's those three main numbers, with the hits being the lowest. I went through a lot, and somebody can correct me if I'm wrong, but it's just such a statistical anomaly. I think it might be the strangest, least likely to achieve statistic in all of North American sports. It's so weird. Like, for instance, Wayne Gretzky is getting 200 points a year in four different seasons, but Mario Lemieux got to 199 once. So it's like ballpark. Somebody's kind of come close. They're within shouting distance. I don't see anyone like, that's a contender. Oh, no, he didn't have this many bases on balls. I don't see anyone vaguely close to this. And so this guy was this hugely valuable player. But also I wonder, I bet you do too, was he thought of that way at the time when batting average was king? Or did people like Jimmy Fox think, oh, this guy blows, I got to carry this
right,
guy.
Right, he's saying, hey, Max, get the bat off your shoulder. Swing once in a while.
Yeah, I want to get some ribbies. but he was getting on base at, I don't know if people know what numbers mean, but like 400 on base percentage is really good. You can be a guy who's like a top 10 a few times in your career and on base percentage, like Carlton Fisk, for instance. But I think his career on base percentage was like, might have been under 350, and he was good at that. So it's difficult to get over 400 on base percentage, which just puts like hitting 400 in a completely different realm, right? It's a mind blower. But Max Bishop, I don't know, man. I've never seen anything. It's like fascinating when you can read these. I had a girlfriend once, and she'd see me staring at these numbers, and she thought I was like a loser. She's like, why are you staring at them? They're just numbers. I'm like, no, they're stories, baby. She's like, yeah. Suck. And he was gone.
Finally, we wrap it up with Colin, and I want to hear your thoughts on this. The greatest sports logos of all time.
Oh, that's right. I forgot when I was dealing with the IRS what we were talking about today. And I think there are a couple of ways to look at logos. There are sort of like classic logos that are always there, and they're perennials, like the Yankees logo, for instance. And the Red Sox one has like changed somewhat over the years, but I really like the one that they had for a long time in the 70s and 80s, where it was like actually the Sox. But then I think you can also look at logos in terms of the quality and efficiency of their design and how much they pack into a design without that design being overly busy. So to me, the gold standard, and we can touch on some others, but I think the gold standard of logos belongs to the late lamented Hartford Whalers, where if you look at this, it's like, I wonder if part of this was just dumb luck. Somebody had an idea, and then it counts when you get something like this. Sometimes, like things when you're writing a story, they just sort of like fall into place. It's like, oh, it does work better that way. You weren't even trying. I wonder if the logo was like that, because in what looks to be the negative space, in addition to the W for like the Whalers, which probably wouldn't be like politically correct now, most people don't notice the H for Hartford, how that's fit in there in that negative white space. So you're really getting everything in there. You're getting the whale's tail, you're getting the W, and you're getting the H. Like, that's a lot of information to pack into a really clean-looking economic logo.
I love a lot of baseball logos. I love the Dodgers, especially the Brooklyn Dodgers, the simplicity of that. The Yankees, it's hard to argue with that as well. I even like the Mets logo.
Yes, I like the Mets colors. In the 1980s, like the Mets and the Oilers, those were kind of like cool, on-the-rise, flashy team colors. I'm sure you know why the Dodgers are called the Dodgers, right?
They've been dodging trolleys, the Trolley Dodgers.
Yes. And that was just ported over from Brooklyn, too.
Now, what I didn't know about the Mets logo is this, that they borrowed their colors from the previous New York teams that had headed for the left coast, that they took the Giants orange and the Dodgers blue to create their colors.
Yes, and what a scene that must have been before everyone kind of scattered, right? Imagine that, having those teams, that many teams, in like one area. I'll tell you what's another good one, and kind of like the Hartford Whalers mode, is the Milwaukee Brewers.
Great logo, yeah.
You have the glove. Now, what's sort of strange, and I kind of like, there's a demerit for this, is that the glove is missing a finger to make it work.
Right.
So it's just like, you know how in cartoons, a lot of cartoons,
only four fingers. Yeah.
So it's a Homer Simpson glove, I guess, or like for Fred Flintstone, it's for him to field some rocks in the outfield. But I've noticed that logos have become really blasé. And they used to, again, that notion of, they used to just go for it. Like, I would get these sticker books of NHL and Major League Baseball teams when I was a kid, and like the Houston Astros and the Calgary Flames. It's like everyone had a really identifiable, distinct logo. And I think it's interesting because that sort of paralleled that in sports back then, really not now. Teams had different styles on the field or the ice or the gridiron or the basketball court. Think of it like remember the 1985 and 1982 St. Louis Cardinals? That they'd hit like 60 home runs as a team all year, but they win the World Series in 82. They probably should have in 85. They're jobbed on a call. And they played a completely different way than like the Oakland A's of 1988 were playing. Like teams in hockey, they had different styles. And I felt like this was also represented visually and the logos. I really enjoyed that. It wasn't plastic. It wasn't samey. And now logos oftentimes, unless they're old and they've lived on, they're simple, they're formulaic, and they're carbon copy. A lot of times, like the actual teams and the way they go about their business on whatever strata they play on.
I think the one I liked best as a kid, and it was probably the first hat or piece of swag from a team that wasn't the Red Sox, when I was a kid, the old Baltimore Orioles, when they had the bird with the cap on.
Oh, yeah. Beautiful. And the color scheme.
Oh, yeah.
The Pirates. And then even like 70s teams that you don't think that much of, like that submariner fork for the Seattle Mariners. And I wanted to ask you, do you remember when people started showing up to games wearing things like shirts and caps? Can you pinpoint in your mind like a sea change with that? Because you can do it pictorially. I've been doing this lately. I can sort of tell when it was. I wasn't there, but I can tell when it was just by looking at old pictures from games.
I feel like it was in the 80s, because I don't remember as a kid when I first started going to Fenway Park in the late 60s and 70s, and that was the days where men were still wearing suits to games often. I think it was the 80s or 90s probably.
Yeah, it was the 80s. It's like you can kind of see this inflow of hats in the late 70s, like the souvenir shop across from Fenway thought, we're going to sell some caps.
Yeah.
Like 70 bits at a meeting.
And then the starter with those satiny starter jackets.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. So it wasn't jerseys at first. It was that jacket that you would have as a kid. It was the same jacket that, like, Mark Clear remember him. Like, some of these references, they must be golden for, like, four people out there. But like, oh, Fleming hit the sweet spot. And everyone else must be like, he is on that bottle. But, like, Mark Clear would have that, like, sort of warm-up jacket, yeah, bullpen circa 1982 at Fenway. And that's what you'd see people wear, like on Cheers.
Yes, you're right. Yes.
And Coach wears like that. He wears that jacket. I think Sam has one too. But the idea that you throw on your, what is it you told me you had? You had your Dustin Pedroia, and you're always like wearing that around the school. And like, I won the MVP in 2008, kids. And that didn't, I don't think really that was a thing until, like you said, probably even like the 90s. I always think it's a little weird when I see some guy who's like 56 wearing like a Mac Jones jersey.
Yes.
Like, to me, you can only wear, the rule is you can only wear the jersey of someone who came before you or like was older than you.
All right.
Maybe
so
not a lot older.
What's
that's
worse? Is it worse, the guy wearing the Mac Jones jersey or the guy who gets the Patriots jersey, but with his own name and number on the back?
I saw some guy who, this is weird. He got a jersey of the Detroit Tigers. This was on Facebook. He's like, yeah, I didn't know who to put on the back, and I always respected his tough style of play, so I got Probert. He's got, like, Bob Probert's name on the back of his Detroit Tigers jersey, but because he represented the Motor City. You couldn't get a 13 in a parish on the back. It needs to be Probert. Like, you need to do mixed sports metaphors.
Yeah.
But I'm a guy, for instance, I have my all-time favorite Patriots, Andre Tippett. So I have an Andre Tippett, and I have a John Hanna. I think he's their all-time second-best player.
Best.
So, but they were, like, older than me. So I feel like that's allowable.
We'll let it go. Absolutely. Hey, listen, Colin, great to catch up with you, as always. Wish you well. And if you need to, we got some talent. We got some tools around here. We will bake a cake with a file in it, and we will spring you out of Danbury if they continue to push this thing.
Oh, I thought you were going to offer, like, your accountant or something like that, but let's not even. I think I told you I worked at a hardware store once, and there was this Puerto Rican guy who had murdered someone, and he had been in jail, and he said to me that I wouldn't like jail, and I said, well, why? He said, because you would be one of the women's.
That's why we're here for you, Colin.
In a way, but like not really what I would do.
That's what I always say. I have delicate features. I wouldn't do well. We wish you well in the next week, Colin. We'll visit with you again next Tuesday.
All right. See you, man.
Colin Fleming, downtown.